show that looks at Kansas City baseball's past, present, and future.
High fly ball. Motley going back to the track. No outs to go. The Royals have won the 1985 World Series.
Davis comes to the plate. Strike three called. It's over. They've done it. The Royals are World Series champions. The world champion Kansas City Royals.
This is the Kansas City Baseball Vault.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome in to the Kansas City Baseball Vault, brought to you by Kelly's Westport Inn, Baseball Prospectus affiliate. Folks, we're starting to get in the thick of it here. Baseball season is really rolling now. We're here. No more crazy two games in 5 days format. It's going to be day in, day out for the rest of the way. But before we start getting into that, the introductions, as always, they don't call him the Wanderer for nothing. It's Michael Engel. Mike, how are you doing on this fantastic evening?
The Wanderer? That's weird.
You know, sometimes I like to fly off the cuff, and I just...
I don't know what to make of that.
Sometimes I check out thesaurus.com and see if I can find an applicable adjective. Other times, it just comes out of me. And there
I get it. I mean, I'm the kind of guy that likes to roam around, so...
There you go. You know, Lawrence, Kansas City, Lawrence, you know,
pretty much
being in there is what it is.
Anything but Topeka.
Anything but Topeka.
To the Topeka listeners.
Sorry if you're a Topekan.
We just lost Topeka.
The Electoral College will not
right.
Kansas City Baseball Vault in Topeka.
We're polling poorly in Topeka.
My first job I had, I was an external auditor. And one of the clients we had was in Topeka, and I had to drive there every single day to and from. From Kansas City.
Oh, that sucks.
So awful. We got mileage, though, and that was back when gas prices were just, like, way huge. So the federal reimbursement mileage rate was, like, 55 cents a mile. So it was, like, getting an extra paycheck a month because it was, like, 70 miles each way.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's like $70 a day in reimbursement for mileage. So that was pretty cool. But overall, it still sucked.
Right.
Ugh. But those days are long gone. And now I do a Royals podcast. So we can start talking about the Royals now.
They have actual results.
Actual results. And while the sample size is still too small to draw many conclusions, it is ever widening. And the first thing we can talk about is, you know, it's been a very Royals-like start to the season. So as of recording this, which it's Wednesday, April 13th, as of this recording, the Royals are 5-2, currently in the first inning of their third game of a four-game series at Houston, but 5-2, and they have had two really solid wins, and then they've had two close kind of games that are just close games that they ended up winning, and then one game that they had no business winning against the Twins, but they ended up pulling it out somehow.
Yep.
So, I mean, this is what the Royals have done, is they have created this team and this kind of culture, attitude, whatever you want to call it, where no matter what the situation, I mean, any game, even against Noah Syndergaard and the Mets, when it was 2-0 going into the eighth inning, you thought, man, this is over. Royals got this in the bag. You're like, they're going to bring Tyler Clippard. Is that who they brought?
They brought in Addison Reed on Addison that game.
I get those two. I don't know why I get those two mixed up, but I
relievers are fungible. So
that's true. They bring in Addison Reed. I'm like, the Royals tagged him in the playoffs last year. I was like, this is toast, you know, game over. And the Mets ended up pulling it out to their credit. But, any of the other times Royals have been trailing so far this season, that's what they've done. And, you know, they continue to perpetuate that feeling. And they had, you know, one big loss against the Astros where they got pretty well dominated. And then they had the loss against the Mets where they were still in it. They had their chances against a great pitcher like Syndergaard, and they just didn't come through. And that happens against very good pitchers. So, you know, what are you going to do? But the overall point, I think, to take away from the start is when you kind of break it down like that, and you've heard this before, you know, Mike, we've kind of talked in these terms where, you know, the best team in baseball is going to lose 60 games. The worst team in baseball is going to win 60 games. So at a minimum, you know, unless you're 2004, 2005 Royals, but that's
yeah.
But you know, on average, that's what it's going to be. So what do you do in those in between 42 games? That's what makes the difference, right? And so a lot of those games come down to those one run games, those come from behind victories, those games that you say you have no business winning. And the difference between, you know, I don't think anyone last year, at least going into the season, the way it started, or before it started, really thought the Royals were a 95 win team. You know, I mean, if you look at the Pecota projections, and, you know, we've talked about the issues with those projections and what problems they have. But at the same time, you know, there's an element of truth in there in that the Royals outperform what their projections are. And they've done it for the past few seasons. And that's, you know, kind of like what we talk about with certain pitchers and ERA versus metrics. You know, eventually the actual results are more reliable than the metrics because you can if you outperform it for an extended period of time, which is what the Royals are doing. But you know, when you're an 85 win team, but you can tip the scales in your favor, those for that extra in that extra little bit enough times over the course of a season, then it's going to end up with 10 wins. So that game against the Twins that they had no business winning, they're playing awful, down two runs in the eighth inning, and they come back and win it. You know, that's one of those games where we very well may look back in September if it's a close race and say, man, that game was huge. We may just forget about it. But, you know, that's one of those games that's in that category, and there's probably going to be 20 or 30 of them that in the season that could kind of go either way. And if the Royals can tip the scales in their favor enough, then that's how you end up winning 95 games. And it's really, you know, when you talk about possible World Series hangover, a lot of possible more expectations and pressure on wanting to win a second one, going to the World Series or the playoffs in the World Series again, those types of things. It's good to see kind of business as usual so far in the first week and a half of the season for the Royals.
Yeah, I mean, of those, the first five wins, four of them are by one run. And what you've seen is, you know, the Royals get one opening and they make it happen. It's, you know, you get Terrence Gore on and he works a bad pickoff throw that gets him to third base. And then you take advantage of a wild pitch. I mean, just that's something that only the Royals seem to do. And you get guys on via errors, or you know, you advance or you score on errors. You know, it's basically that idea that you give them an opening, they're going to take it. And they've done that so far. They held the lead against the Mets, but they had to come back against the Twins. And in a couple of spots, they took advantage of some poor defense by different fielders on the Twins who were playing either out of position or a position that they're not as familiar with, or who had just come in. You know, and you've got guys diving for balls they have no business diving for because they're not as experienced or they're not executing quite well. And that's how you give up a triple to Sal Perez, or how Eric Hosmer can get a triple in the bottom of the ninth off Glenn Perkins. And that's what state, you know, that starts the comeback. And that's, it's got a lot of that same feel as a lot of the games last year where the Royals just seemed to kind of get through. And maybe those are the games that, you know, you should have, they probably should have lost them. And if you can take them out of that loss column and put them into the win column, that adds up after a while. It's a talented team, but when you get those different marginal kind of situations, that makes a big difference. And I think that's what they did a lot last year. I remember a few years ago, the Orioles were really good in one run games. I think it was maybe 2013 or something
yes.
like that.
Mm-hmm.
And the feeling was just that, okay, they're not going to be able to be that good. But the Royals have those pieces to do that. They've got great defense pretty much at every position. Right field's negligible. Second base is meh, you know, whatever. But they've got good enough starting pitching, and they have a great bullpen that can either protect the lead or hold a game so that the Royals can actually come back. And it works out. It's just it seems repeatable.
You know,
it has been.
It's really funny that you say that, because that's exactly the point I was going to make, that the typical thought process for teams that, you know, were really good in one-run games, and some of the thoughts from that Orioles team going into 2014, you know, when the Royals played them in the playoffs, they were good in one-run games in 2014 as well. And the kind of prevailing thought before the 2014 season began with the Orioles, if I remember, was just kind of that you can't repeat that. That's something that is
just
not
very repeatable. There's no way it's going to happen again.
And they did repeat it for 2014, but then they fell back last year, you know. And so the Royals, they did in 2014, they repeated again in 2015. And I think you said it exactly right. The way the Royals have structured it, the way they've set themselves up, it's something that is repeatable. And that's where building that bullpen comes in, and the high contact rate, or I guess high contact emphasis, we'll kind of talk about that a little bit later in the show, as far as related to this season. But that stressing that contact ability, making that, you know, just putting the ball in play, making things happen, you know, that by it's not something they just say. It's something where they look for these defined skill sets that they need to make these things happen, and then they actually put them in practice, and it happens, and then, you know, they win a World Series. So they have that, and that's why people are starting to emulate it, because they realize, you know, even though before you think, oh, well, putting the ball in play, you know, it's just kind of a luck thing. You want players with good plate approach. And, you know, well, that's not necessarily, you know, untrue. At the same time, there are, you know, being able to make contact is a skill, and the Royals were able to define it and seek it out and find the right pieces, and then put the right mentality around them. And then once you get all of them together, and they realize, hey, you know, I don't have to be the hero. You know, I think Eric Cosmer, when he came up in 2011 and he had all that success, and then in 2012 he kind of took a little bit of a step back. I think he was going to be that hero. He was going to be the guy, and he wanted to be. And so, you know, nobody thinks that way anymore. It doesn't really feel like that, because everyone knows if I don't do it, the guy behind me will. So I'm just going to go up here and try and make it easier for him, you know. And I think that's kind of
just keep the line moving. It's what works out to where, you know, especially last year you saw this, and having Ben Zobrist helps. You know, last right, year during definitely. The playoffs, but where you've got Alex Gordon hitting eighth, you have an all-star guy hitting eighth. I mean, that extends the lineup that much. And even though this year they don't have him, you know, you still have seven guys who have been all-stars or have been productive hitters in some fashion. I guess you could hedge a bit on Alcides Escobar, but, you know, it's still, you've got to get through those guys, and they're guys who will put the ball in play and make you make plays. And, you know, you give them one opening, and they will take it. You let the ball get past you up the middle. There you go. You're gonna blow a lead in game four of the ALDS or you know, game four of the World Series. It's just, that's the Royals' game. It's put it in play. If you follow BABIP and believe in BABIP, hey, 30% of the time, that ball's got a chance to fall in as a base hit. So, you know, the other times maybe you get an error out of it, and it seems to kind of work a little bit. I think they kind of discovered they had the personnel like that and then started selecting. I don't think it was necessarily the initial part of the process, but, you know, that's one of the things that you look at this team, kind of how they lucked into Wade Davis and Lou Kochaver being great relief pitchers. Once they saw what worked, they were very quick to commit to it, and it all added up to work at the same time. And that's kind of the hallmark of this team. And they're doing the same thing this year.
Yeah. And I mean, we do know that they've stressed athleticism in their scouting and, you know, player decision-making, and we do know that they've stressed, you know, kind of contact in the minor leagues. So that, I do think there is a little bit of that organization wide, but I do also think, yeah, that we don't want to give them too much credit, because they did kind of, you know, I think a lot of the credit kind of comes from, like you said, adapting to that personnel that they had instead of trying to continue with whatever method they had there. They said, okay, we want people with good contact, and then we get up and we say, okay, we got all these guys. And when you talk about BABIP, you know, If you are a believer in that, and it's not just one person, which is I think what makes the Royals unique. You know, it's not just one person that's kind of gaming that system, if you will. It's all nine batters. And so if you have all nine batters that are working this BABIP angle and it hits on that 300 rate that you talk about, which is, you know, the typical league average, then that's three hits out of nine batters, you know, relatively speaking, assuming they all put it in play and everything is, you know, of course, evenly distributed and all that. But, and so, you know, it's just, it's really, the Royals have really kind of found themselves a unique team, and we've already seen a lot of people or a lot of teams try and kind of emulate a lot of what the Royals are doing. And my real big, and obviously because the Royals are good now, we're not in that look ahead mode like we've been in the past, but I am kind of curious when thinking about the future of the Royals, looking towards specifically 2018 after this potential mass exodus. And we'll have a little bit more on that as well later in the show. But if the Royals are going to be able to repeat what they currently have, you know, are they going to be able to take this contact bullpen, et cetera, philosophy and apply it to another group of players? Or are they going to have to relearn what makes a winner again? And not necessarily meaning they're going to have to go through 20 years of losing, but just kind of relearn, okay, with the new personnel we have, how do we make this team a winner and adapt to that process? You know, I'm not sure, but that's going to be fun to watch in a couple of years, but it's going to be plenty of fun in between then as well.
Right. We still got a couple of years till we got to worry about some of those things. And, you know, I think they'll continue to just kind of see what they have and go with it. It's not like they have a high strikeout, high home run type of guy. It's not like they have a lot of hitters like the Cubs.
No.
Where, yeah, you might get 30 home runs from everybody, but you might get 200 strikeouts from everybody too. Which, if it works, it works. You know, it works and you steamroll guys 18-2, but if it doesn't work, you get swept in the league championship series. And,
you know, these things happen.
Just, you know, kind of how it goes. One bad week and you're toast. And, you know, that, I guess it doesn't mean that one approach is better or worse. It's just they're different and the Royals are doing what they can do, you know, to make it work. And, you know, this season starting out with a lot of that same kind of stuff. They're not hitting quite as well. In general, they were hitting a lot better to start last year, but you know, they're doing just enough. And that's just kind of, that's the formula for the last couple of years, is just do enough to give yourself a chance so that in the late innings, you can come back and do something. And it's the formula that works.
Yep. It certainly has. And, as we've kind of talked about with their good start, we've mentioned the pitching a little bit. And we'll kind of take a little bit more of a dive into that. So with seven games, we're coming up on, as we record this tonight, as I mentioned on Wednesday the 13th, Yordano Ventura is starting. This is the second start of the season. So we're making our way through the rotation for the second time. So we've seen everybody at least once. And initial impressions, I'll say what mine are. Mike, let me know what you agree, disagree. Call me an idiot on what I think, but I thought Ian Kennedy looked very, very sharp.
Yeah,
that was, I agree was with that. Very impressed. I was not sure what to expect. First of all, just because he's not quite a reclamation project, but he was a guy that I think the Royals are betting on him improving, and many people that didn't like the signing. We're suspecting that he would, he would not improve. So there's that. And then on top of the fact that he had to have his first start of the season pushed back because he had his hamstring issue, that was something where you said, okay, I don't really know how this first one's going to go. I was preparing myself. I was in my head. I was preparing the excuses for Ian Kennedy having a poor night, you know, going six innings, giving up four runs, whatever. And, you know, oh, well, he's got the hamstring, blah, blah, blah. But he came out and just looked lights out, looked really good. 6 2/3 inning, almost made it a seventh. Only one walk, seven strikeouts. And, just pitched a fantastic game for his first outing. And so, if he could do close to that the rest of the season, then the signing for this year will be a huge, huge win. I mean, if he does exactly that for the rest of the season, he's Cy Young, but yeah. That's not going to happen. And then we kind of talked about it last show, because at that point, Ensign Volquez had made his first start and he looked really good. And then, in his second start, he looks solid again. I mean, he's the Ensign Volquez that we expect, that we saw last year. He gave the same kind of stuff and looks pretty good. So, you know, if he can continue on that route and give you what he gave last year and what he's given the first two starts, again, that's another thing that the signing will be a huge win for the Royals, and Volquez will give them exactly what they need. And then now we get into the kind of question marks. We talked about how the Royals, there's really no next step to take because they're World Series champions, but you know, the Royals becoming even better, even more of a juggernaut, part of that rests on the shoulders, or right arm, I should say, of Yordano Ventura. Because if he becomes the pitcher that his talent says he can be, then, man, the Royals can just go even further, can be even better than they were last year. And he had kind of a maddening first start. I mean, he pitched was it 5 1/3 innings? He didn't even make it. He started pitching the sixth, but then he had two base runners and got yanked. You look at it and you say, okay, 5 innings. He only gave up 2 hits, only gave up 2 runs, and he had 6 strikeouts. So you look at that and you think, all right, okay.
Yeah.
You know, pretty good. I would have liked to see him go further into the game. But then you look and you see, oh, he had 6 walks.
Yeah.
6 walks to go with the 6 strikeouts. And it's kind of perplexing at that. I mean, he kind of would walk some guys, but he's never been like a huge walk guy like that. And that's just, I mean, 6 walks in a game, that's a lot. So that was a little disconcerting for me. I really thought he was going to start the season strong. And, you know, it's a solid start. I wouldn't call it a good one, but, you know, obviously they were able to win that game, I believe, right? That
was they lost the Chris Young game, and they lost game 2. They lost both Chris Young's games. Sorry, Chris Young. He pitched okay in the first game, in the first start.
And that was, you know, that's kind of the next point. I was that he looks like he's pitched okay. He's given you what Chris Young needs to give you. Like 2 runs in 5 innings, I think, in his first start. And
yeah, it was one home run was what he allowed. He wasn't sharp, but he didn't make a lot of mistakes, but the one he did make ended up in the right field seats. So that
happens
when you don't score a run. That's it.
So. And then, you know, Medlin, he had his first start last night, and he not quite as maddening as Yordano Ventura, but similar. 5 innings again. He gave up 2 runs. Notice the theme here, possibly, right, with those pitchers. 5 innings, 2 runs, 6 hits, 4 walks. Neither of those are 6 hits. Okay, I guess, but 4 walks, not very good. But 7 strikeouts for Chris Medlin. So, and he struck out he gave up a 2-run homer in the first inning, and then he struck out 4 batters in a row after that. For the first time in his career, he'd ever struck out 4 batters in a row.
Surprising a little bit, but
seasons. So it seems like, and I heard on the radio that in talking to Dave Island even kind of prepared the media for that. He said, "Don't be surprised if Medlin comes out, he's a little shaky in the first inning, and he kind of has some jitters and stuff, and has to work through it." And you know, he finished the rest of that game pretty strong. So. Initial impressions, really like what I saw from Ian Kennedy and Ensign Volquez. I'm pleased with those two. I'm disappointed in Ventura's start. Chris Young, I think, is about what Chris Young can get, and I am cautiously optimistic about Chris Medlin. Do you share any of those sentiments, or do you have any differing opinions on any of those?
Well, I like Volquez coming out. I wouldn't expect 9 strikeouts often from him. The Twins they're playing so poorly right now.
They're a terrible.
They're not doing very well. But he also found that they were more than willing to go chasing his off-speed stuff. And I think all of those strikeouts were on like changeups or curveballs going out of the zone. And it was like once he saw that tendency, he honed in on it and he was just going for it. And that's, you know, he doesn't have to strike out a bunch of guys all the time. If he strikes out a few, that's fine. What he's really doing well is he's controlling walks. I mean, he didn't walk anybody in that Twins game. Kennedy, I think when you saw him against the Twins, you saw a lot of what is a skill set of his. Hunter Samuels on Baseball Prospectus Kansas City wrote a thing about Ian Kennedy pitching inside the strike zone. And he is one of the best pitchers in baseball at getting swinging strikes on pitches in the strike zone. And you saw that against the Twins. He was just throwing strikes and they were missing it. But he looked great. He looked really good. And I wasn't sure what to expect. I was, you know, kind of anxious just because, well, you know, there's a signing. I'm pretty okay with it, but I know a lot of people aren't. And I know that people want to just get riled up if something doesn't go well. So, you know, that was on my mind. And then he came out and he looked really, really good. I'm not sure what to make of Ventura. They say that he's made adjustments on how he sets up in his delivery, which is kind of okay. But even with that adjustment, he still had those six walks. But for some reason, the Twins are really patient against him. It just seems like, I think Dave Lesky...
Nobody else.
But... Nobody else. Dave Lesky pulled up stats of them in his starts, and it seems like they see like an extra pitch per batter all up and down the lineup against him, just because I don't know why. I don't know if it's his particular mix of pitches or what. I'm not sure. So I don't think the six walks are really going to indicate anything. You know, he did get six strikeouts and he didn't really look like he was struggling or anything. I mean, he just kind of got through it and just, you know, did his best without his best stuff and kept him in the game. And they, you know, ended up pulling it out. Medlin was okay. It's exactly like you mentioned with Dave Island kind of prepping people. He looked like a guy who hadn't really pitched in a while, and he hadn't. I'm surprised they didn't get him a little bit of work in one of those games, just give him an inning to kind of, you know, just throw and face live batters in a real game. But he gutted it out, and, you know, his last pitch of the game was probably the toughest one, that curveball to get Colby Rasmus striking out with guys on, and that set up the rest of the game for, you know, for the bullpen. And so I think Medlin, once he settles down, he's probably not going to run into a 30-pitch first inning all the time, and that's going to help him get through to maybe those six or seven inning starts. And, you know, Chris Young, like I said, on his first start, he didn't look very sharp. His second start, he kind of just had to wear it a bit. You know, they go into the home opener in Houston against, you know, the team that the Royals eliminated in playoffs. Chris Young's a fly ball pitcher. He doesn't throw very hard. He's got a good slider, but it's not like a wipeout swing and miss kind of pitch. It's more of a, I'm going to pop this up and be off balance pitch. And Houston just pretty much beat him around. They hit him hard through the whole game, you know, so I'm not really worried about his second start as far as, you know, oh gosh, he's, you know, going to cave every other start. That's a bad environment for Chris Young. So I'm not too worried about that. I don't, you know, guys like Young and Medlin, those are your four and five. If you get one good start, one okay start, and, you know, just kind of see what you can get and minimize the really bad ones, that's kind of where you're at. And I think that they looked good enough that I think they can give you some good starts. They can be okay most of the time. And, you know, they're like anybody else, they're going to give up some rough ones. But starting pitching's been effective. And for, you know, one of the reasons that people cite it as Royals are going to fall off, you know, the rotation isn't as strong. You know, they came out and kind of answered that question at least the first week. So that's definitely beneficial. It's encouraging if you can come out and have everybody in your starting rotation at least have one pretty decent start in one way or another. And I think they got that from everybody.
Yeah, you know, no huge complaints for me. And then we can kind of talk about the bullpen for just a little bit here before we go to the break. But so Joaquin Soria somewhat of a maligned signing by many. You and I were both lukewarm, more positive than negative on it. But regardless, he's had four appearances so far, one really good one, one really bad one, and then two kind of in between. He's had four appearances, right?
He's had four.
Three. He's had four. Okay, yeah. I was second guessing myself right when I said something like that. But what do you make of what he's done so far? Because for me, I have faith in Soria just because I know the pedigree that he has. I know he had a really good season last year and he's had his difficulties, but coming back from injury, it's so hard to really evaluate that in terms of skill level. And, you know, I kind of trust the Royals at this point when it comes to signings like that and the amount of money they've invested in him. But I don't see what he's done so far, the issues that he's had as a problem. I just kind of look at it and see a little early season. He's just kind of barely missing his spots. And I don't know that he's used to playing in front of this defense and in this team and, you know, kind of getting acclimated to, you know, being a Royal again, being back into. And I kind of talked about on the radio on my way home that I thought was kind of an interesting side of it where, you know, he's come back to a familiar organization in the sense that it's still the Royals, but completely different from the one that he left in 2012.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they were still floundering, still trying to find themselves, still trying to be competitive. And now they're World Series champions. And the expectation is that, you know, people have to try and compete with them, not the other way around. So that's an interesting angle to add to it, you know, as far as the mental aspect. But I mean, when you look at him, do you feel concerned yet? I mean, it's obviously still a small sample size, but, you know, four appearances is in seven games is pretty decent.
Yeah, I'm not really concerned. I mean, I will admit that last night when he was set up to face the second, third, and fourth hitters of the Astros lineup in a one-run game,
my heart started going a little bit.
That was a little different. I really would have preferred to have Kelvin Herrera in that spot, but he got through it. And he looked good doing it. The one appearance that really sticks out is that first night against the Mets where he gave up three runs. And the biggest problem there was just his fastball command. He couldn't locate it, couldn't hit his spots. And if you can't locate your fastball, your secondary stuff is basically useless, you know, because they can just
Soria with a 92 mile an hour fastball.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can spit on the curveball. He didn't even throw the curveball that much. I think he threw, I don't know what he was throwing. Cutters, changes, I don't know. So they, you know, he didn't give them a reason to do much of anything. You know, they just kind of waited it out and took the balls that weren't in the zone, and he walked a couple guys, but nobody hit him hard. So it's not like he got hammered. It's not like they were just bashing it against the wall every time up. It was, he walked a couple guys and a couple of jam shots, you know, just dropped into shallow left field. And that's pretty much all that happened. It still counts, but, you know, it's not like those are screaming line drives into the gap and, you know, he's given up
just
extra base
shelled.
Hit. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, and then he gave up a home run against the Twins, but it was, you know, it was a bad pitch that was up, you know, one mistake.
These things happen.
Not that worried about it. Now, I still think that he should be, I'm not sure if I would just anoint him as the eighth inning guy, which
that's
it seems
actually,
like.
Sorry to interrupt. That's actually what I wanted to talk about next. I mean, how do you feel about that? Because if it's me, I go with Herrera, and I think that both Herrera and Hochaver, especially with what they did in the playoffs last year, have earned that spot over Soria. Where do you come
out? Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think they definitely have. I think Herrera right now is – they're both throwing really great. Hochaver's awesome. He looks great. Herrera looks great. You know, I think that for what they've done, they certainly do get a crack at that. But what I was kind of thinking was like, it always comes down to like, hey, this is seventh, eighth inning guys. You know, you get the seventh, you get the eighth. And, you know, on one hand, yeah, that guy knows that, hey, it's this time. It's my time to warm up and get ready and stuff. But I think when the Royals have a deep bullpen like this, they can maybe be a little creative. Like I was thinking about this earlier today. You know, you remember, I think it was 2013, they had Greg Holland and the bullpen guys made shirts And it was, they made shirts for themselves, and it was all the silhouettes of the bearded, you know,
bearded
silhouettes. Mm-hmm. And they all had one, and the thing on it was, get it to this guy. And the this guy was Greg Holland. And Holland had a shirt that said, the guy, or I'm the guy, or something like that.
Yeah.
And the whole idea was just get it to that closer. And if you follow that same kind of thing, like, you know, instead of assigning guys particular innings, I mean, I think if you get five or six innings from your starter, you know going into the seventh which batters are coming up. So if you know, hey, I feel I would rank them Soria, Hochaver, Herrera on the hierarchy going from bottom up. If you've got the bottom part of the order there, go with Soria. If you've got, you know, any of the other spots, top of the order, maybe you go with, I don't know who you, maybe Hochaver, but you basically you play it like a matchup, kind of like you're shadowing a cornerback, shadowing a receiver or something. And you match it up that way. And that way, if you've got the middle of the order coming up in the seventh inning, well, you go to Herrera, you shut them down, you go to Soria to set up the bottom of the order, and then you go with whoever's left, in this case, that'd be Hochaver, to get the, you know, the next batch, and then you get it to Davis, to whatever. And it's all just finding how to get those 6 to 9 outs between the starter and Wade Davis. And not necessarily worrying about the inning, but worrying about who you're facing and matching it up that way. And, you know, Hochaver's been used pretty flexibly. They brought him in with runners on. They brought him in to start innings. He seems pretty comfortable with that kind of role. And I think at this point he's battle tested enough that, hey, whatever, you know, he's just going to go do it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that would work for this group. It's, you know, they've all been guys who have pitched in late inning situations before. They've all taken their turns closing here and there. Hochaver, maybe not as much, but Soria, obviously, and Herrera can fill in if he needs to. So, I think if you just look at it as a task of getting two or three innings worth of outs and you try to match it up with the best matchups and not necessarily, you know, okay, well, it's the seventh inning, let's get Herrera up and then make sure Soria is ready next. But, you know, just kind of look at who's your best guy right now and who do you want him facing. And I think that Jeffrey Flanagan earlier tweeted out something that Yost said that, hey, he might mix it up, which we'll see. He still has to go try it, but you know, it might be something that would be worth doing. You've also got enough guys that you can give a guy a day off and mix and match that way. So I don't think that it's necessarily in stone that, hey, Soria is the eighth inning guy all the time. You know, they've got enough guys that if he falters a couple times, they can make the switch pretty easily. So it's not like, you know, when you're waiting on the Jonathan Broxton to get traded so that Greg Holland can finally close games. It's like,
right.
You know, you can just go ahead and make whatever change you need to make and just have at it. And, you know, I think the Royals have the right personnel to do something a little bit different than just, hey, this is your inning, go to it.
Yeah. And it's really interesting because, you know, the flip side to the matchup argument is that part of the reason that the Royals have been so successful is because of, you know, Ned Yost being very clear with his players of what their defined roles are and knowing, you know, no matter what the situation is in the seventh, no matter who we're playing, you're our guy and we know you're going to do it. You know, so, I mean, there's something to be said for that. You know, if it's me, depending on the team, you know, I kind of, depending on the situation, I would probably skew more towards what you were saying. For instance, let's say it's game 6 in the ALCS and you're playing the Toronto Blue Jays.
Right.
And they've got this ridiculously massive power lineup. Why don't you go ahead and put Wade Davis in there instead of Ryan Metz? And that's a kind of decision that, but see, that's, you know, right. That's just it though. He rides or dies by that particular, you know, this formulaic role by the book that he himself has written in terms of, you know, his own team as Ned Yost. So, I mean, that's kind of the flip side argument to it. And like I said, I'd probably skew more towards your method if I had a choice. But, you know, there is something to be said for the, you know, knowing your role. And I do wonder, too, if there's a little bit of with Soria going in the eighth inning, if there's a little bit of, hey, it's easier to go from the eighth inning to the sixth inning than it is, you know, if he starts off having problems in the sixth inning or something, you know, moving him to the sixth forward, trying to find a space for him, if he doesn't do well in the sixth inning or something like that, I don't know if that's the thinking there, but it wouldn't surprise me if it was.
Yeah. And I think as long as they're all pitching well, yeah,
it hasn't cost any games yet.
Yeah. You'll figure it out. I mean, it was all Chris Young gave up the runs and took the loss on those games. So it's, the bullpen really hasn't done anything to cost anything. So I think as a group, I mean, you've also got Danny Duffy hanging out in there that we haven't even talked about.
Who could have an appearance?
Who could fit in any of those spots? But he's just, you know, he's kind of more of another matchup earlier, and you know, maybe lefty specialist. It'll shake out. I'm not worried about if Soria continues in the eighth and if Yost doesn't go with the, I guess, shifting group like I thought up. I mean, if he does, cool. I'll take the royalty check or something.
Take the credit.
But if he doesn't, I mean, it's still a lot of really good relievers going in late inning situations, and you know, I trust the Royals to do pretty well in that situation.
Yeah. So with that, I think we'll take our first break. When we come back, we got a few more quick topics we'll hit on the offensive side of the ball, and then kind of one big topic about the Royals' future looking forward a little bit, both the here and the now, and then the future a little bit. So stick with us. We'll stick with us through the break, and we'll see you back on the other side.
The Kansas City Baseball Vault will be right back after these messages.
May all your good fortunes be as numerous as blades of grass and then some.
The Vault.
Kansas City is excited for a world championship defense in 2016. After setting team attendance records last year, the Royals have become the hottest ticket in town. There's nothing like watching a game at Kauffman Stadium, but if you're looking for an alternative or you can't find a ticket, you should try Kelly's Westport Inn. Kelly's Westport Inn has TVs all over, spacious lower floor, and more upstairs on Randall's rooftop. You'll always find a friendly bar staff that are ready to talk Royals baseball with you, and they have drink specials every day. It's a great place to watch a road game, and if you were there for any of the playoff games last season, you know how fun and wild it can be to cheer on the boys in blue surrounded by other Royals fans. And how about this? You don't have to pay $12 for parking. Kelly's is located in the heart of Westport, where they've served the best drinks since 1947. Let their tradition become part of your tradition.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Kansas City Baseball Vault, brought to you by Kelly's Westport Inn, a baseball prospectus affiliate. Thank you for sticking with us through the break. And as I mentioned before, we got some quick hits to come up. Just a couple things worth mentioning. We'll talk positive first.
We're going to do a Royals compliment sandwich.
Yes, exactly. That's what we're going to do. So after a couple games, Royals, I think, were the last American League team without a home run after three games, I think. Mm-hmm. And then finally, Moose broke through with a home run. Lorenzo Cain hit a home run. And they've both now sort of hit another one. So they've both hit two. And Morales has one in there as well. So
he home has run two bats, as well.
Oh, does he have two? I didn't realize he had a second one. My bad.
Yeah, he had one in the game they lost in Houston. So.
Oh, that's right. Okay.
Yeah, it was a bomb, too. but it was, you know. Royals were already down like 8-0 at that point, so it was like, psh,
yeah,
rough day.
So, so the Royals have the home run bats have after the, I guess you could say three games is a slow start, but I've kind of woken up and they've at least hit one. You know, it wasn't like, was it a It wasn't.
Was that 14 or 13?
Yeah, where it was. How many games was it?
It was like 9 games. And then when
it was Escobar, wasn't it?
It was Gordon, but the one that he hit out was very clearly it scraped the fence basically on a windy day.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's where the wind aided phrase came from,
yeah.
But I would not be surprised.
Yes.
So, yeah. That was a weird year.
It was.
I remember at least that period. I don't remember what year that was. Was that 14? I'm pretty sure it was 14, but at any rate.
It was a year.
Was that 13? Because it would have made sense if it was 13, because that was right after they fired Seitzer and said that everybody was going to hit 30 home runs.
Yep.
In the end of season presser.
And who was the what was the name of that guy? The coach, the hitting coach.
The one they hired to replace him. It was
and then moved him down to the minors.
It was Andre David was one of them, and I don't remember the other
guy
dude.
with the mustache. What was that guy?
I honestly don't remember. He was only around for 2 months.
I know. It's hard to remember.
It's like, I don't remember. And they didn't keep him on as a catching instructor like Pedro Grifol.
Yeah.
I don't remember. That had to have been 14, right? Yeah.
I think.
Man, I really suck at remembering my hitting coach chronology.
Our hitting coach chronology. We need to work out here.
But I can't name all the drummers in Spinal Tap either, so.
Yeah.
You know, what are you going to do?
What are you going to do? So,
at any rate, where were we? Home runs.
Home runs. They've happened. No longer have to talk about it. That's great. And then kind of a compliment sandwich within the compliment sandwich. We'll talk about Gordon here. Mike, I'm not sure what you think, but as far as defensively, I think Gordon looked better than he did all of last year. So far, he's made some good plays, because I think last year, even before his injury, he kind of felt like he might have been slowing down. And we're like, is this the beginning of the end, if you will, for Gordon's defensive prowess, where he kind of slowed down? But I don't wonder if there was a little bit more to him having a little bit more injury all season long. But he looks better this year in the early going, and he's made some typical Alex Gordon like plays. And I'm, you know, very pleased to see that. What I am not pleased to see is that he has 12 strikeouts already, and he looks pretty lost at the plate. I mean, what's your evaluation on Gordon when you see him both offensively and defensively so far?
The defense, I'm not sure if I see a huge. I think he's had more opportunity, or at least of the opportunities he's had, a lot of them have been plays where he can go make a pretty good play on it. I don't remember really what he looked like last year to start out, but he also had a wrist injury early last year too. And I don't know if that held him back.
As we're talking about this, Gordon strikes out again.
Yeah.
So now it's 13.
Yeah. So it seems like he's just not recognizing the ball right now. That's just what it seems like. He's been caught looking a couple times, and it's on spots where, okay, why didn't you swing at that? You know, so maybe he's guessing wrong. Maybe he's just not seeing the breaking pitches. I haven't looked at, you know, what pitches he's missed, but I would hazard a guess that it's of those 13, I would say 9 or 10 are probably on breaking pitches that he's swung and missed at out of the zone. That would be my guess. So I'm going to have to take a look at that when we're done recording and see if that's true. You know, I mean, he's still got a couple hits, so that's a good thing. It's not like he's completely over, but, you know, you bring him back in and, you know, I think he'll be able to adjust pretty easily.
He's had slow starts before.
Oh, yeah, he's definitely had slow starts. So it's not a huge concern. It's definitely disappointing because he is somebody who, yes, he's struck out often in the past. I've definitely say more than about anybody as a rate. On this team, which, as we've talked about, is contact oriented, but at the same time, he walks a lot more than pretty much anybody. So he's seeing more pitches. He's putting himself in a position to have more two strike counts, perhaps. And, you know, so it's a little bit of you take this and take that, and you just kind of, you know, let it all work itself out. I just don't think he's seen the ball very well. And I don't know if that's just, it's just that's how it's starting. And, you know, he's kind of run into an early slump to start the year, but I don't think it's going to continue to where he's striking out, in half of his plate appearances. So,
I don't think Alex Gordon's going to go for the casual 250 strikeout season. That's not typically his style. So,
no,
I think we can set ourselves at ease for that. But we will finish up the show with a final point talking about Eric Hosmer. So as far as starts to the season go, he hasn't hit a home run yet, but he's had a pretty good start to the season. Some key RBIs, some big hits. Really feels like he's kind of stepping into that kind of big time, I'm the guy type role. He looks more confident at the plate. He looks, he's still got the when we saw last year that he had a good approach at the plate, he looks like he looks closer to that than he does back with the times when he's had not a good approach at the plate. He's hitting the ball with authority. He just happens to not be hitting it over the fence quite yet. I think it'll come this season. And so that's very positive. And looking towards the future, before the season started and really got going, there was some talks of, Eric Hosmer made some quote, with Alex Gordon coming back and Salvi getting renegotiated. Salvi renegotiating his contract and getting all that. Then, obviously somebody asked the question like, oh, would you like to renegotiate with the Royals?
Are you next?
Yeah. What's he going to say? Of course. But, he did seem genuine and I'd really like to stay here in Kansas City. And I don't know why you wouldn't. You just won a World Series. But at the same time, it's going to be easy to say that and leave with a clean conscience when, the Yankees offer $150 million and the Royals offer $75 million. Mm-hmm. It's like, sorry, Royals. I love you. But, so, when you look at the possibilities of Hosmer signing, I know you've done some research on this, Mike. So kind of tell everyone what you found in terms of because there's as far as comparison point, who's a good, I know you found a good comparison. Tell everyone kind of give the details on that, on what we could possibly expect as a place to start for Eric Hosmer.
Well, the tough part of this was this is something we were going to try to do as like a special topic, like last July or something, of like, hey, what would an Eric Hosmer extension look like? And the problem was that as a first baseman, Hosmer's in a weird spot because, first baseman, generally they fall into a couple categories of either guys who aren't really that good and you can kind of mix and match guys like James Loney, who's in the minor leagues for the, I think, Padres now.
Oh, James Loney. He had one good season for the Rays, didn't he?
Yeah, and he was a good player coming up with the Dodgers, and it's not like he's a bad player. It's just that he's up against the other group, who are the Albert Pujols and Miguel Cabrera and Paul Goldschmidt and those kind of guys. And so there's this really kind of like spread of guys who aren't really that great. And the closest contract you really had, as far as extension, was Freddie Freeman of the Braves. I would say Freddie Freeman of the Braves is a more productive player than Eric Hosmer, and he got a pretty good deal. It just didn't seem like it was going to be the kind of thing that would match up with Hosmer. He was the closest. Otherwise, you're looking at Joey Votto and Miguel Cabrera and Goldschmidt and guys who are all-star starter, 30 home run, 300 hitter type guys. And Hosmer's not that guy right now, and maybe he never will be. But last week, Brandon Belt of the Giants signed a deal with the Giants to stick around, and it finally kind of falls into place where these guys are fairly similar. Their batting lines are very close to the same. For the career, Brandon Belt has hit .272, on base of .348, and slugging of .456 over his career. Eric Hosmer hitting .280, .336 on base, and .427 slugging for his career. Really, really close. They're both left-handed. They're both pretty good defensively. And so it finally makes sense. So Belt is going to basically get like a 5-year, $73 million deal. That'll keep him in San Francisco through the 2021 season. They both debuted in 2011. They would both be free agents after 2017. I mean, it is like down to almost everything. They hit about the same number of home runs per year. It's kind of uncanny. Hosmer doesn't get on base quite as much, and he doesn't strike out as much. Belt has a little more power, strikes out a little bit more, and has a worse injury history. So they're very similar. That being said, I wouldn't expect Hosmer to go for any kind of deal like that because of a number of reasons. One, Belt is 30 this year. He's going to be 30 when he's a free agent, rather. Belt 28 this year, Hosmer 26. So by the time Hosmer's a free agent, he'll be 28 years old, right in that peak curve of his career. Belt, when he would have been a free agent, would be at 30, when that same kind of awkward, well, is it a peak, is it a not? So I think that the market for Hosmer when he would be a free agent is going to be greater than what Belt's might be. Plus, you've got 2 years for other contracts to increase, you know, and inflate salaries and things like that. You run into the thing where, hey, Eric Hosmer could be a free agent and he's going to have 30 teams able to negotiate with him versus just one. So I just don't think – I think if he was going to take a deal, it would be somewhat in this range, probably a little higher. I mean, I think you could probably look at like $17 million a year, give or take. You could probably find a way to do signing bonuses or options to defer some of that off of the year-to-year payroll. I think the Royals can afford it. But another factor that should come into play as well is that Belt is going to be sticking around on a Giants team that's going to have Buster Posey through 2019, I believe is his contract. Bumgarner, Brandon Crawford, those kind of guys, they're going to be around for a while. Those are some core guys. For Hosmer, you'd have Sal Perez, sure, but maybe not Kane. You'd have Alex Gordon for a few of those years. Sal Perez, I think I sent him. Maybe not Moustakas. Maybe not Escobar. It's tougher for me to see that, okay, our Hosmer's going to stay because this core is here, when you're going to have a pretty wildly different team as far as like the principal guys. And so that's why I'm really skeptical of Eric Hosmer doing any kind of extension signing. Plus, the Royals basically have one offseason. They have the 2016 winter into 2017 to do it. They're not going to negotiate during the season to make it work. Belt, I think they started the groundwork before the season started and finally kind of finished it up. But if it was like June, I don't think they would have done anything. So, that's probably pessimistic, just because I'm not sure that Hosmer is going to do that. I would really like it if he did. But at the same time, the Royals have to evaluate, hey, is he going to be a guy who can, be a 20 home run, 25 home run, potential 300 batting average guy or not? And so far, he hasn't done it. Now, if he comes out and does that kind of thing this year, then maybe they do get a little more interested in going out there and trying to do something. That's kind of how it boils down to me. But at least we finally have a good contract to compare to, a good situation where these guys are almost the same player, statistically speaking, in many, many ways. The age is different. The injury history is a little different. The agents are different. That's another big one. But so many things are similar that it at least gives you that idea of, hey, this is something that is in the Royals' range if Hosmer's willing to do it. And, maybe he is sincere. Maybe it is something that he really does want to stick around and continue everything and see how it develops after 2017. And if he does, I'll be happy. And if he doesn't, well, we'll always have that mad dash home. So.
Yep, that's true. We always will. And one thing I wonder a little bit is how much of a difference being Eric Hosmer makes in this scenario. And by that, I mean, Hosmer was the number two overall pick in the draft. Or wait, was he number two or number three?
He was number three.
Moose was two, right?
Moose was two.
They were back-to-back years. I always forget. Okay.
Yep.
So top three pick in the draft. A lot of hype coming about Eric Hosmer. A lot of hype through the system. Had success at every level. He was supposed to be that guy. He's starting to be that guy. Everyone looks to him. He's basically, as far as media is concerned, he's the face of the franchise on Jimmy Fallon, that guy. Brandon Belt, he's he was a fifth round pick. He was a college guy. which, you know, college players typically have, you know, a little bit less hype than high school players coming out, just usually for the age reason. And he's older than Hosmer, you know, and he's on a team with Buster Posey, with Madison Bumgarner, guys who get a lot more of the publicity than he does. So I wonder how much of a difference that makes, you know, if Hosmer is a fifth round pick, and if Hosmer wasn't, you know, supposed to be this year, if he was a surprise coming up instead of a, instead of the sensation like he was, you know, then is it a different story? Does it become easier to negotiate in this scenario? And then all of a sudden the Royals are, I feel like if that was the case, they already would have had him to a 5-year, mm-hmm. $7 million contract, you know, and he would have been glad to sign it.
He'd have been like a fifth round guy who they felt good about, but didn't anoint him as, I keep saying anoint.
That's basically what happened. The media did, whether the Royals.
Yeah,
did.
He was going to be that guy. And, you know, to an extent, he has kind of been that guy. I mean, he's on the cover, or at least in the commercials for the show, and he's the first guy they usually have on MLB Network to do interviews, and, you know, he's doing all this other, you know, he's the face of the franchise, you know, from the outward kind of perspective. It's not necessarily maybe he's the guy that you associate first with them, but, he's pretty close. I mean, Gordon, Hosmer, Sal Perez, those are probably the three guys that if you say Royals, those are the first three guys you think of right now. Mm-hmm. And that, yeah, I mean, I think it's a smaller market than San Francisco. Yeah, San Francisco's like fourth biggest market or something. Fifth, I don't know.
Yeah,
Royals are certainly smaller. But Belt doesn't have to be that guy in a big market. So it's a little different in those kind of little ways with those franchises. So, yeah, Hosmer's a big fish in a smallish pond, and Belt can just kind of be a guy in a really big city that, oh, yeah, they also have Steph Curry in, Oakland, but same difference.
It's
San Francisco and Oakland fans are cursing at me now, too.
He probably lives in San Francisco because nobody lives in Oakland.
No, I don't think so. And he can afford San Francisco, probably barely, but.
Yeah, Steph Curry can probably barely afford San Francisco. That's how ridiculous it is.
I think we just lost Oakland and San Francisco too. Oh, now.
We're ticking them off.
And that's California. Those are urban centers. Those are.
I know. Those are big time. We're complimenting San Francisco though. We shouldn't be losing them here.
Okay, that's true.
So San Francisco, come back. Come on back. It's okay.
They're San Francisco.
They are San Francisco. Do you find that you irrationally hate any, like, I liked the Giants before 2014. I was like, man, it's kind of cool. The even year thing is fun, and, you know, they're a fun team and they got fun players and stuff. And
then Bumgarner shoved
now
it down our throats.
Irrationally hate them. You know, same deal with Syracuse. You know, orange is my favorite color. And they play KU in the championship in 2003. I always was kind of like, you know, oh, Syracuse, good for them. And then now I irrationally hate Syracuse.
Yeah, the Syracuse thing.
Am I alone in that?
No, the Syracuse thing is definitely, I still have that. Arizona still stuck in there. That is the splinter that will never come out. San Francisco, not so much, surprisingly. And I don't know if maybe that's because we beat the Mets or because the Mets made themselves a bigger bunch of whiners.
We'll go with whiners. Because last
year, Syndergaard stuff. We had to wait through ceremonies stuff. Oh, they're gonna retaliate.
Well, plus
that's annoying.
And to your point, like there was the Giants stuff, and no sooner than the next season started, it didn't even have time to stew because then it was all of a sudden
it was everything
else. There was the stuff with the A's. There was the stuff with the White Sox. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden the Blue Jays in July. And then the Blue Jays again in the playoffs. And then the Mets. And so.
Yeah, I definitely dislike the Blue Jays.
There's a lot of things to take away from that. You know, it wasn't quite like this season where it was end beating the Mets in kind of a contentious series. And then boom, start right up. Hey, it's the Mets again. Guess what? We still won the World Series.
Yeah, I guess it. I don't know. It kind of bounces around. Like the Astros, I don't like playing them right now. I really don't like playing the Astros because they're a really good team.
Very talented.
And they terrify me to no end. And they're young, and they're going to be good for a long time. But I don't like. I mean, other than like Colby Rasmus, who's kind
I respect
of
what they've done
really,
to build that. team.
Oh yeah, yeah. It's like even Dallas Keuchel who owns like okay, cool, that's fine. But guys like Toronto, everybody on Toronto, I really don't like anybody on Toronto.
No, not a one.
Like I don't like anybody there. And some of that is due to the July series and the nonsense that happened with, you know, the oh he threw inside, you can't throw inside and da da da.
Blah, blah,
all that dumb stuff and you know but I don't know. I don't know if it really follows so much with some of the you know other teams just because we face them in 10 situations. The Orioles are really annoying. We lost Baltimore.
See, for me that's not a huge deal.
I think it's mostly
especially I just do not.
Oh yeah, the Angels are inert. The Angels were inert when they're good. So it's like even when they're good it's like you still don't care about the Angels. Because whatever, we just lost Los Angeles. They're not paying attention anyway.
Yeah,
they don't care.
So San Francisco, you got to hold strong for the state of California. With
this. Right, terrible.
San Diego too. We haven't made fun of the Padres yet, but I'm sure that time will come.
I don't like their uniforms.
they've got James Shields, so that's you know there's that.
They have Will Myers too.
Oh, they do
and they didn't score for the first three games, and then they scored like 30 runs in the next two.
That's what happens.
So
there it is. So as we've now begun to ramble,
right?
I think we'll go ahead and call it a day.
It's probably probably good before we
afternoon. Yes, on
before
that,
we we'll offend any other large cities,
if you will. Yeah, before we offend any other large population centers
or small ones.
You know, either or.
Liberal Kansas, we're coming for you.
We're coming for you next, Liberal.
That was our high school rival, and they beat us in everything.
I have a friend of mine from college who was originally from Liberal Kansas. He didn't go to high school there, but that's where he grew up. So fun times. So with that, we will leave you this evening. More Royals action to come. We'll have, you know, this is a good barometer, this Houston series, because I think Houston's going to be a very competitive team this year. They might even win the West. It'll be... this will be a good barometer so far. Split. We'll see how these next two games roll out, and we'll have plenty to talk about again next week as we will return, as we do every week and as we plan to every week for the rest of the season. So stick with us. Make sure you go to bpkansascity.com. Read Baseball Prospectus Kansas City. Dave Leske, Craig Brown, Hunter Samuels, all great writers. Everyone else is on there whose names I'm not forgetting right now. But
there's a lot of us.
There's too many to name. So. A lot of good stuff on there. Our podcast is on there. It's kind of a catch-all. If you want Royals, that's the place to be. So thank you again for listening. This has been the Kansas City Baseball Vault, brought to you by Kelly's Westport Inn, Baseball Prospectus affiliate for Michael Engel. I myself am Jeff Herr. Thanks for listening, and as always, go Royals.
Thank you for listening to the Kansas City Baseball Vault. You can follow us on Twitter at KC Baseball Vault. You can also find us on Baseball Prospectus Kansas City at bpkansascity.com. You can follow BPKC on Twitter at bprokansascity. Also, you can subscribe to the podcast through iTunes, through Stitcher, or whatever podcast app you like. And if you have any questions, comments, or if you just want to say hi, send those emails to kansascitybaseballvault@gmail.com.